You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported podcast network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. This year, we're celebrating 10 years of food radio. For the past decade, we've been taking you behind the scenes of farms, restaurants, breweries, school cafeterias, and more. It's been 10 years, and we're just getting started. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Today's program was brought to you by Sushi Master, the new book by Nick Sakagami.
Food, a podcast about innovators, entrepreneurs, career changers, and cool people who have done other things but now work in food, beverage, hospitality, and in this case, aquaculture, oyster farming.
You can call it that.
All right. I'm your co-host, Ethan Frisch.
I'm your co-host, Jenny Dorsey.
And we are back in the studio together, which
Yay!
Hasn't happened in, I mean,
a while.
The break between the seasons notwithstanding,
sure.
It hasn't happened
Feels
in
like
a while.
Forever.
I know it does. So now... we get to eat oysters together, which feels like a good celebration coming back for our, what is this, the eighth season?
Season eight, yeah.
All right, so season eight. And we're also very happy to be joined this week by Peter Stein, who is the founder and oyster farmer at Pico Oysters. Thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here.
So tell us a little bit about an oyster farm. What does an oyster farm look like? If you were walking along the beach, would you be able to tell that there was an oyster farm off the coast?
Most beachcombers probably would not know that there's an oyster farm there.
What does it look like?
So I think that's one of the kind of cool things about an oyster farm is that, you say farm to almost any American or any person in a civilized culture, and they're thinking, okay, well, to use an American example, rows of corn or tomato plants, what have you, as you drive through the countryside. An oyster farm is very much the same thing in that there is a product growing there, but it's all below water. And as humans, because we are an amphibious, we don't, our kind of mental grasp of the world in many cases ends at the waterline.
Mm-hmm.
And so the visible components of the oyster farm, aside from what is actually very important, is the infrastructure that exists either on a boat on the bay or at a facility on land. The oyster farm is not really visible. You see some buoys and that's about it. And then, you know, a boat that might be tending to those buoys and what sits below the surface. There are other oyster farms where, there are kind of two categories of oyster farms. One is what is called a subtidal zone, and one is called an intertidal zone. I work on a subtidal zone, which means that my oysters are always below water. There are intertidal zones where, a lot of people know that, like, on the Cape, when it's low tide, there's like a mile of beach that wasn't there at high tide.
Mm-hmm.
That would be an example if you were growing oysters in that shoreline, where that would be an intertidal zone, right? So the oysters could be in cages or on tables or some, and at high tide they're submerged, at low tide they're exposed to the air.
Does that change the oysters at all? Or
so some people say that, you know, it might grow a little bit of a stronger oyster because, you know, when they're out of the water they have to be a little bit more exposed to the elements. Mm. And out of their natural environment. I think by and large to the end consumer, aside from perhaps different flavor profiles, it's not going to change the physical appearance of the oyster all that much.
And so those buoys that are on the surface of the water, there are ropes extending down or cages. How do the oysters grow?
Yeah. So the oysters, I often have to remind people that I am a farmer, not a hunter gatherer, right? So like when we pull back into the dock at the end of the day or something like that, and people on the beach or in the tiny little town of New Suffolk where we are see us, like sometimes they'll come down and be like, oh, so how good catch today? And I'm like, yeah, the high seas were rough, you know? And that's just not the case. Like we're not out on the high seas or to the extent that we can avoid it, we are not. So we are very much farmers, not hunter gatherers. There are cages below the surface. Different oyster farmers use different styles of cages. mine appear, basically it's like a 3 foot by 4 foot footprint. That footprint is a steel base to serve as a weight, an anchor. And then stacked above that steel base are trays, wire mesh trays, that are kind of like the oyster farming version of Lincoln Logs. They fit together and they stack on top of each other. And then they are then bridled together with either chain or rope. And that chain or rope is then attached to that buoy line. So you can pull up next to the buoy, grab the buoy, hook it into the different kind of rigging or equipment that we have on board the boat, and hoist that cage up from the bottom and onto the deck of the boat and do what you need to do with it.
Do oysters have natural predators that you have to be aware of as they're kind of hanging out in the elements?
Good question. Yes, they do. So these cages help to protect the oysters from some natural predators. There are other predators that can get in through the wire mesh and actually cause some serious damage to the population or the crop of oysters that we have. One of those is known as the oyster drill. I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. That's kind of like what we call it. If you asked me the scientific name of it, I would not know it. I know how to identify it out on the farm. I know some ways in which you can get rid of oyster drills, but I don't know. It kind of looks almost like a tiny little mini conch shell. Huh. So kind of what actually, if you just saw it, you would say, oh, that's kind of a pretty shell, but it's pretty bad for an oyster farm. There are some sponges that can actually affect the structural integrity of the oyster shell itself, which won't kill the oyster, but will make it like, if you've ever shucked an oyster, if you've kind of gone to open the oyster and the shell crumbled or exploded, that's because the shell is getting really brittle. Oftentimes that has to do with a sponge. And that's another kind of what I would say is not really classified as a predator, but certainly
a pest.
Yeah, a pest or an annoyance on an oyster farm.
And you've only been an oyster farmer for about 3 years, is that right?
I'd say that this is my third year.
And how did you? Where did this idea come from? How did you get into this?
I grew up loving the East End of Long Island, fishing, clamming, being on and in the water in many different ways. And I had let's call it a blank space, a white space moment in my career back in late 2015, early 2016. And I decided to look into different industries. I was in the world of educational software, and I decided to say, okay, you know, if I didn't want to pursue another job in educational software, what would I want to do? Because of my affinity for the oceans and fishing, I started to look into, I had had some exposure in the past, just tangential kind of articles, books that I'd read about farming, about aquaculture, and fishing. And I started to look into it. And I just really went out and started asking people questions. And I read one article that to this day I think of as like a very kind of important moment in this career discovery process. And that article was about a gentleman who I'm sure has either been a guest in this studio or you know of. His name is Bren Smith, and he runs an organization called GreenWave. And they do some he is probably one of the foremost thinkers on kelp in the world. And I read an article about him. He had just at that time won a prestigious prize known as the Buckminster Fuller Institute Prize. And I thought what he was doing was fascinating. And it's happening in New Haven, Connecticut. And I said, well, that's just across Long Island Sound from where I enjoy my days out on the east end of Long Island. If it's happening there, that's not too different than the east end of Long Island. Why can't it happen there? So I kind of took that curiosity and started asking questions of people in the community out in the North Fork of Long Island. And a lot of questions and a lot of conversations later, I wound up owning an oyster farm.
It was that easy.
I mean,
had some conversations and suddenly you're pulling oysters out of the water.
Yeah, it certainly was not that easy. There's a lot of education and getting kicked in the behind by Mother Nature in between that, that curiosity and owning an oyster farm. But I mean, I didn't want to dive down into every little minute detail of, losing a whole bunch of oysters over the winter of 2016 into 2017.
Losing them how?
Weather, basically. I mean, I didn't really know what I was doing. I had equipment in the water and it got destroyed by some Northeasters over the course of the winter.
What would you do now to prevent that?
Well, I use different equipment. I know that, a lot of these things are very much site specific. I was using the wrong equipment. I was securing it, inappropriately. There were a number of things that I had done wrong. And as you get significant wave action in that particular spot, especially in the prevalent or predominant winds of the winter months out on the east end of Long Island, that spot is particularly exposed. And as a result, my cages kind of tumbled around and were destroyed, and the oysters scattered across the bay. So I lost a lot of them. Thankfully, I was able to recover some. I think I look back on that and, every oyster farmer has a story like that. I mean, mm-hmm. Every oyster farmer, if they tell you that they haven't killed more oysters than they've brought to market, they're probably lying. that was a learning experience. In the same way that you pay tuition in certain academic institutions, sure. I paid tuition on the oyster farm.
Can you walk us through just the starting steps of an oyster farm? Where do you get the little oysters? How do you kind of get the sort of initial setup? How do you even choose the right spot to put down these oysters?
So I can speak to how it works in New York. It's going to be different across different states. So in New York, most oyster farms start by applying for a lease from, at least in eastern Long Island, from Suffolk County. That can differ depending on the town that you're in. If you're on the Sound side, it could be through the state of New York, but let's just stick with a lease from Suffolk County. So once you've secured a lease from Suffolk County, you can then get your permits from the Department of Environmental Conservation and the Army Corps of Engineers and the Coast Guard. And with those permits in place, you can then start to put gear and oysters in the water, which you then have to source from. I get little baby oysters from these businesses called hatcheries, where they actually spawn the oysters. So they have brood stock and they spawn oysters in tanks and then culture algae in order to be able to feed the oysters as they grow. And I buy oysters, let's call it around the size of a dime.
How old is an oyster at that size?
Probably, I want to guesstimate, like 4 to 6 months. That would probably be better answered by someone at a hatchery. A rule of thumb, and this is going to differ depending on the climate and the latitude, but a rule of thumb is that like an oyster grows about an inch a year. Mm.
How does that fluctuate with the temperature?
So usually oysters grow faster in the warmer water, right? I mean, as the water has warmed up this spring, I mean, we're already seeing like, quarter inch, half inch growth on the oysters.
Oh, wow.
That we're starting to cultivate on the farm. So I buy oysters at about a dime size and then tumble them and grow them out until they reach market size.
What is market size?
So there's no, for commercial oyster farmers in New York, there's no, like, whereas in Connecticut, it has to be 3 inches. In New York, it can be less than 3 inches. But I typically think of market size as a 3-inch oyster.
And that's the length of the shell, or how, what's that?
The length of the shell.
Okay.
So from kind of that beak or that peak to the more rounded circular edge, that length, I like to sell a 3-inch oyster.
Is there a maximum size that an oyster can grow to?
So I don't know that there is a maximum size or that we've discovered a maximum size of an oyster. I do know that many oyster shells have been discovered in New York City, that the shells were the sizes of dinner plates.
Oh, wow.
So you're talking
a
like
steak oyster.
Yeah. 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 The porterhouse for two. So, you know, you're talking about an oyster that's 12 inches.
Wow.
As opposed to, and you know, some, like we have found out in the bay, like we found some ghost gear, what we call ghost gear. Just like the buoy got clipped. It wasn't even my gear to begin with. So it's been sitting there for years. And we found a cage full of oysters out in the bay last summer. And it had probably 50 oysters in it that were the size of like a man's tennis shoe.
Wow.
So you're talking not quite a foot, but like 8 inches,
what'd
10
you
inches.
Do with them?
Yeah, did you eat them?
Yeah, we ate some. We shucked. A lot of them had really bad sponge, that sponge that I was talking about. Mm-hmm. So I didn't want to sell them. And there's not a big market for like oysters
massive
that size. Yeah. You can find some pretty cool YouTube videos of like people eating them in particularly in like Japanese fish markets.
Okay.
But we basically shucked them. We used them in like, I made like a linguine with clam sauce, but with oysters. Mm. You know, I'm not a professional chef, but I like to dabble. A guy who works with me on the farm, he took some home and I think he made some po' boys out of them.
Nice.
So yeah, we put them to good use.
And oysters are also an extremely sustainable option. Can you talk a little bit about like how they interact with the ecosystem and the waters around them?
Yeah. So, I mean, oysters, some commonly known things about oysters is that like they're filter feeders. They're very good for the environment, in terms of cleaning up the waterways. They are incredibly productive in terms of like the, on a per acre basis, a per acre to calorie basis, mm-hmm. Like they are producing an enormous number of calories per acre versus other crops and products, agricultured products. One of the things that I like to share about this that like few people really kind of think about is the fact that actually the equipment that I use to farm or house the oysters in the water actually serves as an artificial reef system. So it provides sanctuary for little juvenile fish. So I can't tell you how many different species of fish, little babies that we see when we pull up the gear, and we often are, you know, kicking them over the side of the boat. I mean, blackfish, porgies, striped bass, weakfish, oyster toadfish. I mean, like all sorts of different fish that we're seeing, eels. And it provides, you know, I mean, we have 50 some odd cages in the water. It provides amazing sanctuary. It's a reef system for these little baby fish. So
what about the oysters like off like New York City, where before, I guess in the 60s, when we used to eat oysters from the Hudson,
mm-hmm.
more readily, and now it's polluted and they're kind of like trying to turn back the tide on that.
Right.
What does that look like? At what point can oysters like be rehabilitated?
Sure. The puns, by the way, are rampant. In the turn back the tide. I mean, there's the foremost kind of organization that's doing this in New York City is the Billion Oyster Project. So oysters, a market size oyster, let's call it 3 inches, is filtering somewhere in the neighborhood of 40 to 50 gallons of water a day.
Oh, wow.
So you can imagine millions of oysters in the water. They're filtering millions and millions of gallons of water a day. If you want to read a really cool book and kind of a cool history of New York City as seen through the lens of the oyster, a book by Mark Kurlansky called The Big Oyster is really excellent. But in that book, one of the kind of factoids to use at your next cocktail party is that New York Harbor at one point in time was home to half of the world's oysters.
Oh, wow.
Like take every oyster in the world, 50% of them were in New York Harbor. Some estimates say as high as a trillion oysters in New York Harbor. So those oysters, right. So the oyster, the waters of the Hudson and the East River and on up a little bit north into more brackish water of the Hudson and all these different tributaries in the five boroughs, and even into kind of like almost like the Meadowlands area, New Jersey, are not approved from a water quality perspective by the Department of Environmental Conservation to be growing oysters in those waters for human consumption. But that doesn't mean that oysters won't grow in those waters and then also provide a net benefit for the environment. So that's like kind of one of the ideas, one of the concepts behind growing all of these oysters in New York Harbor. And New York Harbor is not just like down by South Street Seaport. It's up in the Bronx and you know, Morningside Heights, all mm-hmm. all over New York City. I think Billion Oyster Project has like 22 sites around New York City. And so, yeah, long story short, those oysters are very much cleaning up the waterways of New York City in an incredibly environmentally sustainable way.
It seems like this conversation, right, around oysters and sustainability, this comes up a lot, I guess. What are some of the obstacles? Why are there not more oyster farms, or why isn't this being pursued more or more aggressively? Or maybe it is, and I'm just out of the loop.
So, I mean, I think number one, the permitting and regulatory process to get an oyster to get up and running on a farm is pretty difficult or arduous. It's not necessarily difficult if you put your mind to it. But it's just long and arduous. So you have to have patience. And then, you know, I think a lot of people are attracted to the idea of oyster farming, but when they learn and see how difficult it can actually be and that you're out in all sorts of different weather and, you know, getting beat up kind of like on your boat, out in the rain, the wind, et cetera, like those romantic visions of an oyster farmer kind of go out the window. So you see a lot of small farms out there and like they're doing amazing things with getting these small farms up and running. And what's so fun and cool, I think, about like what's happening out on the east end of Long Island is you have a lot of farmers who, relatively speaking, are somewhat of a small farm and they're bringing oysters to market and they're shucking at vineyards and breweries and different events, festivals throughout the year. And in so doing, you know, chatting with and educating the public about oysters. And so there's a huge, I mean, relatively speaking, there's a big interest in oyster farming. But, you know, I don't know that it will ever grow to the size of like corn farming. I mean, there isn't the demand for it unless we start to figure out other kind of value add products that we can do with oysters. Then I don't know that it ever gets to that sort of size or scale. But, you know, that coupled with the fact that it's so productive. But there are other aquacultured species out there as well that are becoming more and more prevalent and sought after. I mean, kelp is a big one, or certainly the prospect of kelp is a big one in New York waters. It's not like grown commercially in New York waters yet, but we're hoping that it will be.
And I mean, to your point about value-added products with oysters, it does seem like, unlike a lot of other fish species, where you can cook them in a lot of different ways, and there's lots of different traditions around presenting fish in, you know, different formats, different ingredients, different styles. Oysters are, for better or for worse, fairly consistent, right? Like oyster on a half shell on ice with mignonette or lemon or Tabasco or something.
Yeah, we were talking about that earlier. Yeah.
So what's the, like, how do you break through that? How do you get people to use oysters more creatively?
So from what I know of the culinary world, and I'm not, I don't have a long history in it, but I've read a couple of books and I think that, you know, food trends often start with kind of these top-notch celebrity chefs, for lack of a better word. Whether or not they have a million followers on Instagram or not is besides the point. It's kind of like their innovativeness with what they're doing with the food that they're turning out of their kitchens. So I think it's pretty exciting and cool to see chefs doing different dishes with oysters, whether that be kind of using oysters as a stock for like a fish stew, mm-hmm. or the linguine with clam sauce idea. I've spoken with a couple of chefs who are kind of a fan of that idea around, hey, why don't we do linguine with clam sauce, but make it with oysters.
They're also excellent emulsifiers.
Yeah.
For different sauces and such.
Do you like turn them into a paste? Do you blend the oyster?
You blend it with whatever you're trying to do. Like if you're trying to emulsify, let's say, a vinaigrette, you can just toss an oyster in there. A whole oyster.
In a blender.
In the blender with all the other stuff.
Yeah.
Or if you're trying to make a tomato sauce or whatever, and you want to bind it without using, I don't know, xanthan, toss an oyster in there. Obviously, it tastes like oyster. So you have to plan accordingly.
Does the oyster have to be raw or can you cook it?
That's a good question. I've used raw and I've also used a smoked oyster before, and both worked pretty well. So I guess whatever emulsifying properties it has doesn't change.
Cool. All right.
See, I'm learning.
Let's make some oyster
vinaigrette. I should be interviewing you guys, I think.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in 2 minutes. Stay tuned.
Today's program was brought to you by Sushi Master, the new book by Nick Sakagami. Sushi Master is an expert guide to sourcing, making, and enjoying sushi at home. As the only person outside of Japan to earn the designation Osakana Meister, Nick Sakagami introduces the fundamentals of sushi, starting with the fish. Photography from Tokyo's Tsukiji Fish Market offers an inside look at where most of our tuna comes from. And a deep dive into the tools, techniques, and etiquette of sushi ensure you'll never look at a California roll the same way again. Sushi Master comes out on June 4th, 2019.
Hi, and welcome to Opening Soon on Heritage Radio Network. We are your hosts, Jenny Goodman
and Alex McCreary.
Opening Soon is a weekly show that will walk you through the steps of opening a restaurant, through conversations with some of the world's greatest chefs, restaurateurs, and the vendors that help take their business from just an idea to opening soon.
Jenny and I have been in the hospitality business for over 25 years. I've been fortunate enough to be part of opening one restaurant that still stands today, and humbled enough to have owned one restaurant named Goods that lasted less than 6 months. When launching Goods, we failed to create a business plan before jumping in. We didn't bother with a partnership agreement, and we missed some major components of our income statement. Our experience with Goods is a big reason we feel we're the ones that can ask the questions. Basically, we need answers.
Aside from our own firsthand experience inside restaurants, including one pretty epic fail, we are currently the founders of Tillit NYC, a hospitality workwear brand that has proudly outfitted over 4,000 restaurants and counting since launching our business in 2012. We are so fortunate to witness many restaurants come to life. Being part of that journey is one of the best parts of our job, and we want to share that feeling and all those lessons that can be learned with all of you.
Our goal is that this podcast will help bridge the gap between the teacher and the student, help alleviate some of the risk when you're opening your restaurant, and offer you some lessons that you might have been looking for when building your business plan.
So the first 12-episode season will sequentially take you through the steps of your business plan, from choosing your partners to nailing design and to getting those doors actually open. We will be picking the brains of industry leaders, including Chef Missy Robbins, Camilla Marcus, and Steven Satterfield, just to name a few. So if you're in the process of building a business plan, just starting culinary school, improving or expanding in your current business, or just fascinated by what it takes to get the restaurant open, we hope this podcast will entertain, educate, and inspire you on your journey from idea to opening soon.
Follow the journey on Heritage Radio and subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or anywhere else you get your podcasts. And don't forget to follow us on Instagram at We Are Opening Soon and at Tillit NYC.
And welcome back. This is Why Food Podcast on Heritage Radio Network. I am your co-host, Jenny Dorsey.
I'm Ethan Frisch.
And today we are joined by Peter Stein, who is the founder and farmer of Pico Oysters.
And who is currently making Heritage Radio Network history.
Dun, dun,
we,
dun.
We are led to believe. Peter is opening oysters on the air, which Amanda, our sound engineer, tells us has never happened before in the Heritage Radio Network studio.
We're breaking new ground.
Yeah, seriously.
Excellent.
Well, Peter, can you talk us through, what are you looking for when you look at an oyster? how do you make sure that it's a good quality oyster? Are there characteristics in the shell that you're looking for?
Sure. So I think what you primarily want to see is a depth of cup. Mm-hmm. So an oyster versus other shellfish, an oyster does not have what's called bilateral symmetry, right? A clam, the shells are symmetrical. An oyster does not have that. So you want to, there's a top shell and a bottom shell, and that bottom shell, you want to see that depth of cup. So it's tough to see over the radio or over a podcast, but you know, I'm pointing to that kind of rounded cup shaped or bowl shaped shell of the oyster, and having a nice deep cup means that you have like kind of a plumpness or a volume of meat inside of the shell. I think beyond that, like that's what we're aiming for. I think we're also aiming for like the quintessential shape of the shell should be somewhat of like a teardrop, or maybe like a curved teardrop, you know, maybe one half of a,
the yin yang side.
Yeah. Yin yang. You know, look, you're talking about a natural product that grows, like, so not every one of them is going to be like that. But that's an ideal shape for one. What we want to avoid, certainly in the world of aquaculture, is what we call kind of like bananaed or rabbit-eared oysters that become really elongated and kind of like they're harder to shuck. They're not as like, you know, look, people pay top dollar for these things in raw bars. And, you know, to serve them something that as the saying goes, people eat with their eyes. Like you don't want to see that on a plate when you're paying $3.50, $4 a piece for them. So.
All right, so we're not paying $3 or $4 a piece for them. We're just going to eat them right now into the microphones.
Please do.
And
I'm gonna slurp really loud.
Yeah, exactly. And are you... Yeah, that's awesome. Mm-hmm. Do you suggest chewing or swallowing?
I like to chew. Mm. I mean, you know, it's all a matter of personal preference. You know, I like to chew a little bit. It's kind of like a chomp, chomp, swallow.
Yeah.
I like to serve them naked or, you know, unadulterated by any sort of lemon juice or mignonette. I just think that, like, it's a very pure, almost like visceral kind of taste in that, like, it's the ocean. It's the bay that's, like, in this little shell. And I think that's kind of cool and fun.
Do you have tips for opening oysters? What's your strategy?
I mean, so there are two kind of, if you look on YouTube, there are two different methods for it. One is to go through what's called like the bill, which is the rounded edge of the oyster. I can't really do it that way. The people who I see who do shuck oysters that way tend to be pretty fast at it actually. So, but I go in through what we call like the beak. And
sort of the hinge.
The hinge of the oyster. So the two shells of the oyster are connected in only two places. One is that hinge. And then one is, you'll notice on like these top shells that there's kind of like a dime sized little brown, circle at the top edge of the shell. And that's, where the abductor muscle is connected. The same is true as you look at your empty bottom shells, that there's like a purplish brownish kind of color, more or less the size of a dime. And that's that abductor muscle. So that's where the two shells are connected. All I do is I kind of get my knife lodged in to the hinge area there. And I just pry and twist up, almost using the knife as like a little bit of a lever.
Peter's doing this on his leg right now.
wrapped in a towel. And the knife has a little angle in it, an oyster knife.
The tip of it, is kind of has a little, a bend to it.
Yeah.
And then all you do is you simply get the knife into the oyster shell and you slide the knife along the bottom side of the top shell. So that way you're leaving the meat of the oyster in the bottom shell. And the top shell, you're just severing that muscle from the top shell. The top shell then comes off, and all you have to do is just sever the muscle from the bottom shell and just loosen the oyster up in the shell itself so that it slides out and
you can get another one.
Eat another one, yeah.
Can you talk us through like what kind of flavor characteristics change in the oyster depending on, as you were saying over lunch, the miroir of where it's grown, what temperature the waters are, how rough the area is?
Sure. So like miroir is a term that I'm not sure is commonly used out there. Terroir is more commonly known among fans of wine, that the grape takes on the characteristics of the soil in which it was grown. So I often use the example of like a Pinot Noir grown in California versus Chile versus France. And you're going to have, while it's the same grape, you're going to have a little bit of a different flavor profile characteristics of the Pinot Noir grown in those different regions. Oysters are similar in that regard, in that, you know, oysters are grown on this in New York. They're grown in Newfoundland. They're grown in Galveston, Texas. And the water in those areas is very different in terms of temperature, in terms of minerality, in terms of the amount of flow. And even within Peconic Bay out in eastern Long Island, like, you have very different micro estuaries, microclimates within the bay. So you're going to see some different, I mean, look, I think for probably your average consumer who goes and grabs a dozen oysters or a half dozen oysters at happy hour, like, they love them because they're fresh and they have that kind of just burst of flavor and you know, ocean in your mouth. But, you know, if you really sit down, like, I'm talking about somebody who's really going to sit down and do like a taste test and a side-by-side with these different oysters, you're going to see some, you know, a difference in terms of like the creaminess versus the brininess of the oyster, which is typically a bit of a dividing line between an East Coast and a West Coast oyster. Mm. Again, there are many exceptions to this, but as a rule of thumb, a West Coast oyster is going to tend to be a bit creamier, whereas an East Coast oyster is going to be a little bit brinier. So those are some of the kind of flavor characteristics.
Even if they're the same species of oyster.
Yes, right. So same species of oyster grown in Massachusetts versus Virginia, it's going to taste a bit different because of the different, the Chesapeake Bay and Casco Bay, Maine, or the Gulf of Maine, like, those are very different bodies of water. And that has to do with a whole host of characteristics or reasons behind the differences between those bodies of water beyond what I would be able to identify just by having been to those different areas. But that's going to affect the flavor profile of the oyster.
I had no idea until you said when we were at lunch that all the East Coast oysters are one species, because they do taste really different. When I was in Portland, Portland and Maine, when you go to like Eventide or something, they present you an array of oysters. They all look different. They all taste different, even if they, I guess, you right. know, they were the same varietal of oyster.
Yeah. There's, if you look at like pictures of oysters on the internet, like, there's, one called Emerald Bay. And like those oysters, the shell is very much like green. Whereas like the oysters from Peconic Bay have a much more kind of like brown or, gold umber kind of color to them than oysters in other areas. Like I've seen many oysters from Maine where like they're much whiter, mm-hmm. Like the outside of the shell.
And so when you see oysters on a menu, they often have pretty evocative names. Is that, is that marketing? Is that, a description of where they're from? Or is that how are those names?
I would say most oysters are named after like the place where they're grown. An oyster, you know, you've heard of like Wellfleet's or Copp's Island, mm-hmm. or Hummock Island, or all these different names of oysters out there all have to do with like a little point, you know, like Murder Point is in Alabama, right? And there's like this tiny little part of the bay that's called Murder Point, and the farm is within sight of Murder Point, so they call them Murder Point oysters. And it's a fun name, evocative, as you say.
What about the descriptions of the oysters, which are many times very flowery, to say the least?
Well, look, I mean, come on, like, you know, look at the descriptions of wine, right? Like, when you take a sip of wine, are you really telling me that you taste seagrass or blackberries or bacon? Or, like, I mean, I don't, personally, I'm not, you know, a very good friend of mine is in the wine industry. Like, I get that you want to try to differentiate wines by using the written word in order to provide flowery descriptions, but I don't know, I think that's kind of like flowery for being the sake of flowery.
So how would you describe your oysters?
So now you're asking me to be flowery? Yeah.
In layman's terms.
I mean, I'd say they're briny. I'd say that oftentimes, certainly when you're eating the actual muscle part of the oyster, that abductor muscle that I described earlier, that has like a sweetness to it. So those are kind of like the two flavors that I would often use with my oysters are brininess and a little bit of a sweet finish.
In the last few minutes of the podcast, we like to do a kind of rapid fire, more fun question segment. So we're going to throw some rapid fire, hopefully more fun questions at you. And
I thought these questions were, the whole time.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
What
you're
wasn't
right,
fun
right.
about all these other questions?
You're absolutely right. All of the questions are fun. If you could master a skill overnight, what would it be?
Ooh. I think like, obviously these are knee jerk answers, but like, I think woodworking, like wood carving is like really cool.
What would you make?
I think anything from even just like cabinetry to being able to like carve a bowl out of like a piece of wood or something like that. I mean, there's definitely a real skill set there. And I think that I enjoy making something tangible. I think that's really cool.
If you could only eat one condiment with your oyster, so you can't have them naked, but you have to put a condiment on it, but only one for the rest of your life,
Good question.
One would it be?
I'd go with just a really simple mignonette.
Made with?
Made with probably a rice wine vinegar, like minced shallot and minced cucumber, and maybe like a splash of either pineapple juice or sugar in it.
Pineapple juice. Interesting.
Yeah, it cuts like the... Like, have you ever taken a little like sip of vinegar and been like, oh, you're coughing? And it hits the back of your throat, and it like the sugar and the pineapple or sugar and or pineapple juice cuts that a little bit, but it doesn't like take away the vinegar component of the vinegar. And condiments, by the way, I'm a big fan of mustard.
Okay. All right.
Outside of oysters or on your
oysters. No. I've never gone with mustard on an oyster, okay. But hey, we could try it.
Yeah.
We broke new ground by shucking oysters here.
So. Cocktail sauce has a little mustard in it.
Horseradish,
yeah,
for sure.
So
yeah.
we could try it.
Close.
Where's your favorite, what's your favorite oyster preparation or your favorite oyster bar in the city?
Meaning like, can I prepare it at home this way or?
The place that you would go out to eat an oyster. Although I guess you could prepare it if you're inviting people over to eat oysters.
Sure. So I had an oyster at Gramercy Tavern in the tavern part of Gramercy Tavern with like a little dollop of steak tartare on it. And that was
interesting.
Borderline life changing. Mm. It was really, really good. I love like if I'm going to cook an oyster at home as opposed to serving it on the half shell. I love just like a garlic, olive oil, either cilantro or like basil kind of mix in there and then just throw it under the broiler for like 90 seconds plus or minus.
In the shell.
Yeah. So a little trick to that, by the way, is take a baking sheet and crumple up tin foil. So that way the shell sits and it doesn't topple over and the oyster spills out and all the liquid spills out. You keep it like that.
And then broil it for 90 seconds and
plus or minus, yeah.
And then eat it straight up or
yeah, I mean, serve be
it
careful because sometimes
or
the, no, just straight up from the half shell. But you know, careful because the shell is like this is where we have to warn consumers that you know these are pros doing this. but like the shell can be hot, so you got to give it a couple minutes to cool down.
What was your favorite lunch to eat growing up?
Favorite lunch to eat growing up? I mean, I think chicken sandwiches.
Like chicken salad sandwiches?
No. My dad and mom are like big fans of like, you know, taking the leftover chicken breast from a rotisserie chicken or something and slicing it, like home slicing it.
Yeah.
So it's obviously thicker slices than you would get off of a machine from a deli counter. But that with just some fresh veggies like tomato, cucumber, lettuce on a hearty piece of bread would be probably, I think, keep it simple, you know?
Yeah.
And simple is often really, really good.
If you could choose a superpower, what superpower would you choose?
I think, again, I might just keep it simple. Like, I'm going to kind of give a little bit of a different answer. I'd love to be a dolphin.
I think what? Like, a new answer.
Well, it's new in that, like, I think dolphins have a unique power in that, like, they can swim, they're intelligent, like, they can jump and do all sorts of, certainly, like, spinner dolphin are really cool. Yeah. So, like, in that being a superpower and looking really fun, you know, of course I would like to leap tall buildings in a single bound, but like, I think as almost a little bit more of a practical superpower, I'd love to be able to like swim like a dolphin.
At what age do you think it's appropriate for your daughter to have her first oyster, or has she already had one?
She has not. I think she needs a full set of teeth first.
When do they get a full set of teeth?
Well, she's almost 18 months. So, and she's still very much like does not have a full set.
Okay.
And I think like there's a certain dexterity and coordination to eating an oyster that an 18-month-old doesn't quite have yet, right? When she has a full set of, I'll add in a little bit of a caveat there. When she has a full set of teeth and can masters using a fork, then I think she can handle having an oyster. Whether she likes it or not, I don't know.
Are you going to give it to her raw or are you going to cook it?
I would like to give her a small oyster raw.
That's her introduction, her first oyster.
Yeah. I mean, if she doesn't like oysters, then we'll probably disown her. But yeah. Obviously. Yeah. I mean, what else do you do as an oyster farmer who has a child that doesn't like oysters?
How do you store your oysters when you are keeping them for like a big party?
Good question. So if you really want to be a purist about it, you would take them with the cup side down and kind of like line them in a bowl or like a deep tray of some kind, and then put them in the fridge. And all you would want to do is really just maybe put like a damp piece of paper towel over them.
And they're okay for how long?
So maybe I shouldn't be saying this on air, but like, I promise you, I eat oysters regularly. As long as they have been refrigerated, I eat them regularly 2 weeks out of the water.
Oh, wow. And they're totally fine?
They taste as if they were 2 hours out of the water.
Wow. Once I accidentally froze some oysters and then they were no good.
Yeah, they don't freeze.
Do they explode? What happens?
No, they're just dead. So like, they're technically not. They're not. Well, I don't know. You tell me. You're not really supposed to serve them.
You're not supposed to serve them. Like, you can use a frozen oyster for cooking.
Mm-hmm. But you can't eat them raw.
Yeah, so you could use them for po' boys or for a soup stock or something like that. But you're not supposed to eat a frozen oyster raw.
All right. Well, Peter, it's been such a pleasure having you join us this week. And thanks for the first ever oyster tasting.
Thank you.
And where can our listeners learn more about you and find your oysters on menus at New York?
Yeah. You can go to our website, Pico Oysters, P-E-E-K-O, picooysters.com. Instagram handle is the same thing, Pico Oysters. I'm accessible by email, by phone. Hit me up. Come visit the farm.
How far is the farm from Manhattan?
So Manhattan to the farm is probably like, I want to say hour 45, 2 hours.
Oh, not bad.
Yeah.
We can trip.
There's also public transportation.
Do you do tours?
I do some tours. It's a little bit difficult to do them all the time because we have a farm to run. But. Sure. You know, contact me and we'll handle it on a case-by-case basis.
Sounds like fun.
Yeah.
And as always, you can reach us via our email address, yfood@heritageradionetwork.org, or via our Instagram, which is yfoodpodcast. You can contact me via my spice company, Burlap and Barrel, @BurlapandBarrel on Instagram.
And you can find me at Chef Denny Dorsey, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, etc. Big thank you to Amanda, our wonderful sound engineer, and our theme song is Blind by the Red Crickets.
Thanks.
Thanks. See you next week.
When I'm still blind, all the sick things that we've been through.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. for our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.